crystal blue waters.
To celebrate the start of the Commonwealth Games, we're going to show you the Commonwealth as you've never seen it before.
A waterfall.
We've travelled to the ends of the earth
to explore seven of the natural wonders of the Commonwealth.
There are so many treasures within its 53 countries. We've chosen just some that give an insight into our shared history and the Commonwealth today.
It's magnificent. The gateway to heaven.
We'll take you on a remarkable journey to the richest coral reef on the planet. It is incredible.
That is beautiful.
A forest in an ocean. How's that for a wonder?
From the oldest desert on Earth.
It just goes on and on and on.
To the world's greatest waterfall.
I can't believe I'm doing this.
Revealing the most unspoiled rainforest on the planet.
That is what you call shaking your tail feather.
And a landscape.
Oh, wow.
Thought by many to be the most spectacular fjords in the world. And I'll be exploring a surprising treasure on our own doorstep that matches anything the rest of the Commonwealth has to offer.
BBC Seven Wonders of the Commonwealth. A graphic of the Earth turning in space.
The Commonwealth may have its origins in a colonial past, but today it's founded on the coming together of 53 independent nations from all around the globe, united by shared values of equality and democracy. One of the founder members of the Commonwealth is New Zealand. It's the location of our first natural wonder. The remote southwestern coastline is home to Fiordland. Historian Dan Snow is setting out to explore it.
I'm a child of the Commonwealth. My dad's from Britain, but my mum was from Canada, so I grew up in a world divided by geography, but united by language and culture. And this is one remote corner of the Commonwealth that I've always wanted to visit.
I'm following in the footsteps of the great explorer, Captain Cook, the first European to reach here in 1770. I'm about to kayak down the fjord, Doubtful Sound, and then head 50 miles up the coast into Milford Sound, one of the marvels of the natural world. My guide is local kayaker Fiona Lee.
Well, it's just so beautiful, isn't it? I wasn't expecting it to be this lush.
Yeah, we get up to 8 metres of rain a year, which is phenomenal.
Kind of thing you'd expect in Scotland. I suppose that's the funny thing about the Commonwealth. You can travel halfway across the world and see a landscape, hear a language, meet people who are familiar.
But the first people to explore these fjords arrived about 1,000 years before the Commonwealth existed. The Maoris were so impressed, this landscape became part of their mythology.
There was a demigod in the North Island. His name was Tuturaki o Whanua, and he was sent out to create an inland passageway. He planted one foot and then the other and used his magical axe to carve into the landscape.
Oh, this is just the best pastime. Kayaking through fjordland. Oh, what am I seeing over there? Do you see them?
Yeah, the bottlenose dolphins.
Yeah, I can see them jumping. Oh my goodness. Some bottlenose dolphins we've just seen, haven't we? Oh wow. Come on, dolphins.
If you pedal really quick, Dan, you might be able to surf with them.
Okay, here we go. They want to surf in the bow wave. Let's see.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, they are. They're right underneath me.
Woohoo! That's the bottlenose dolphins that live in Doubtful Sound. They're really amazing.
How many of them would there be in a pod?
Oh, the pod is around about 60 in size.
It's actually pretty intimidating. They're big animals, aren't they?
They're really big and fat. They're about 3 or 4 metres long.
Oh, amazing.
Their fins break the surface as they curve out of the water Then one of them swims on its back.
Oh, wow!
Wow! Oh my goodness, that's cool. Yeah.
Not a bad day at the office, really.
Oh, amazing.
The dolphins swim on, and Dan rests his oars on the kayak as he lets out a long breath.
I've never done anything like that at all. What an amazing thing to do on a day like this, in these surroundings.
Yeah.
Is that right? Do they always do that?
Just a treat for us today.
Hello, boys.
A dolphin momentarily emerges.
Doubtful Sound got its name from Captain Cook. He didn't dare enter here for fear the steep sides of the fjord would becalm his sailing ship and would make it doubtful he could ever get out again. For the next part of our journey, we're hitching a lift on a fishing boat.
Speeding across the water.
We're now following in Cook's wake as he travelled north along the coast. Nearly 250 years ago, his historic voyage first brought New Zealand and Britain into contact with each other.
These are the conditions that Cook would have loved pushing his endeavour as it became the first European ship to circumnavigate New Zealand back in 1770. He was looking for the fabled southern continent. He didn't find that exactly. What he did find was just as good. New Zealand and the east coast of Australia, both of which he claimed for the British government. It was a seminal moment in the formation of the British Empire. Of course, that led to the Commonwealth.
Our fishermen are hauling in one of the most lucrative catches in the world.
That was a bumper, that last one. Oh, yeah, every pot's. Every pot's a bit different, you know?
These crayfish sell for over 50 pounds a kilo, and they export them all around the globe.
And how many pots do you look to do in a day?
About 130 at the moment.
Oh, wow.
We can do up to, we can do as many as we want. Up to 200 sometimes.
The boat can make over 50,000 pounds a day. At that price, I feel it's only polite for Fee and I to devour some.
Here we go, guys. I'm very grateful. This is like $1,000 worth of crayfish here. Let's see what these people are paying the big money for.
Oh,
go for
nice
it.
Work, Jane. Cheers. Oh. Good day, yeah.
Dan takes a mouthful.
Not bad, mate.
Fruits of our labour.
I can see why you make good living from this. Have to die for.
I don't really eat it much. We all sort of live on steak and roast and stuff. Yeah.
Back in the kayaks.
It's time to leave the crayfish behind as we're now approaching our destination.
Coming around the corner here into Milford Sound, widely regarded as the absolute gem in fjordland.
Captain Cook, perhaps the greatest explorer of all time, actually missed this jewel. It's easy to see why. The entrance lies hidden behind these rocks.
Wow. Well, that's incredible. What a reveal.
Welcome to Milford Sound.
Oh, my goodness.
The cliffs are even more finely cut than Doubtful Sound. According to Maori legend, this is where the demigod perfected his carving skills.
A vertiginous waterfall.
The centrepiece is the 150-metre-high Stirling Falls. It's fed by the abundant rains here, six times the UK average.
Whoa! It's like being in a storm. Well, you've really got to lean over against the wind. Wow, just incredible.
This journey has exceeded all my expectations. An incredible mix of a unique landscape, Maori myths, and European explorers.
The author Rudyard Kipling said that this Victoria Falls, the Himalayas and the Grand Canyon were four wonders of the natural world. He wasn't wrong.
From the rippling waters of the fjord, the sun setting behind a mountain, to the revolving earth. As it turns, New Zealand disappears.
The modern Commonwealth came into being in the 1940s and has been evolving ever since. 18 countries are represented from Africa alone. Namibia chose to join in 1990 when it gained independence. It's one of the newest members. It's also home to the oldest desert in the world. Anita Rani is setting out to travel from its harsh interior to the treacherous coast and meet some of the people who live in the most sparsely populated of all the Commonwealth countries.
It's three times the size of the UK and has a population of 2 million. I've not seen a soul. It's quite simply stunning. I feel like I'm on Mars.
A pyramid-shaped hill of red sand.
Stepping out into such a hot desert is immediately daunting. The average rainfall here is as little as 2 millimetres a year. And temperatures sometimes reach over 50 degrees Celsius.
Anita clambers up the side of the hill-like dune.
So it was suggested that I should climb one of the dunes. Naturally, I was well up for it, but I thought a quick scramble to the top of something like Canberra Sands. That's what I had in my mind. But these sand dunes are some of the highest in the world. It's more of a mountain range. I mean, it is spectacular, but I've still got 1,000 feet to go, and it's not that easy. Ugh. Whoa.
Her feet slip into the sand as she goes, making it difficult to make progress. Once she's at the top, the desert breeze ripples through her hair and she gazes out at the landscape with a smile. A curved dune.
It's not just the scale of these dunes that's impressive. This place has been a desert for 55 million years. I'm meeting up with research scientist Rusa Gottlieb to find out how dry this environment really is.
Wow, Rusa. What is this place?
This place is known as Dead Flay.
Dead Flay?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Dead Flay just means Dead Valley.
Dead Valley, God.
Yeah, Dead Valley because of all the dead trees that you see.
Yeah, I can see. This one, it's incredible looking.
Yeah, you can see that the wood is still dry and hard.
It's really dry, it's really hard. How old is it?
It's known to be 900 years old.
But in the UK, trees die all the time, but you don't see them standing here for 900 years.
But because in wetter areas, normally it would rain and then the thing starts to rot. But because it's dry here, the tree can't rot because there's no moisture.
From the world's largest dunes to ancient dead trees, this place is both unforgiving and mesmerising. But to get a true sense of the size of the desert, I need to go up.
Anita climbs into a helicopter, and once in the air, she shakes her head with disbelief.
I've never seen anything like this. It's so magnificent. 360 degrees around me, to the horizon, all I can see is desert.
Viewed from above, the dimpled and duned sandscape stretches out to the horizon. Now an ocean laps up against it.
I'd expected the Atlantic coast to offer some respite from the desert, but in fact, the shore is littered with shipwrecks and is known as the Skeleton Coast.
An ancient and rusting ship skeleton.
It's a reminder of just how tough it is to survive in this desert. I want to find out how people not only live, but flourish in what must be one of the most inhospitable environments.
It just goes on and on and on. Yeah. Nothingness.
That's right.
Correct? And no people, no traffic jams here.
Shacks in the distance.
My guide, Wani, is from the Himba tribe, masters of Namibia's harsh environment. He's taking me to a Himba village to show me some of the secrets that help his people cope in this unforgiving place.
Moro, moro, moro. Moro, Rivi, Nawa. Pleased to meet you. Anita. You look amazing. Wow.
To help with the burning sun, the women cover their skin in a paste of red ochre and butter. I've been told it's a natural sunblock.
Now, my mum will be delighted with this because the one thing my mum will do before I'm about to travel anywhere is phone me up to remind me to take my sunblock, which she calls Factor. So here you go, Mum. I'm dousing myself in some natural Factor. What do you think this is? About SPF 50? It'll be SPF 100. We're about the same now. Yeah.
The Himba have another secret for surviving on the desert's edge. The women purify their bodies using perfumed smoke.
It does smell nice. You know, they're in a very dry, arid landscape, and water is scarce. So when water's scarce, you've got to think of alternatives. Let's do mine. It smells good. I'm just going to hang here and try and attract some men that are walking by. Now that I'm all beautified.
A bare-bottomed toddler looks into a plastic pot.
Namibia is a country of contrast. You've got this developing African nation that's a member of the Commonwealth, where some people still live this ancient way of life. You've got this landmass, the Namib Desert, 55 million years old, where it's so dry that trees don't decompose, where you get some of the highest sand dunes in the world, and where the coast is so treacherous that it's lined with shipwrecks. And yes, it is some of the most barren, austere, harshest landscape in the world, but it's also incredibly beautiful. Now, I use this adjective far too much in real life, but for once, I'm absolutely justified. Namibia is awesome.
The Earth spinning once again.
Some member nations of the Commonwealth are surprisingly remote. Nowhere feels more exotic than the tens of thousands of tropical islands found in the South Pacific.
Solomon Islands.
1,000 of them make up Solomon Islands. The ocean here contains 3/4 of the world's coral species. It's said to be 10 times more biodiverse than the Great Barrier Reef. Reggie Yates is flying in to dive a little deeper.
It is hard not to smile when you turn up in a place like this. On my way over, the pilot stuck his head out of the cockpit and said, "You're not in a rush, are you? Because I've got a few things I need to drop off on neighbouring islands on the way over." And when we actually touched down, a group of kids had to disperse because they were playing football on the runway. That was a journey in. And we've not even hit the water yet. Who knows what we're going to see when we get out there.
Solomon's got their name from the first explorers who thought they'd discovered the source of King Solomon's wealth. But the bounty here isn't gold, it's the riches of the ocean. I'm heading to the island of Tetapare, a global centre for marine conservation.
This is the largest uninhabited island in the South Pacific, and it's going to be absolutely stunning.
Reggie jumps into the water wearing a snorkel and mask. He swims over the reef.
This reef is part of the coral triangle that stretches from Indonesia to Solomon Islands. It's larger than the Great Barrier Reef, and it's the richest marine environment on the planet.
Swimming down to the reef.
There's more marine life in a typical reef here than there is in the whole of the Caribbean.
A bright blue starfish, then Reggie on the surface of the water, viewed from below.
These islands are such a natural paradise. People have fought over them for centuries. I'm heading to the ominously named Skull Island with local guide Sunga to find out more about the dark side of this tropical paradise.
A dark wood.
Sunga is one of the few people allowed to take me to this sacred site, the final resting place for local tribal kings.
Hidden skulls.
That's fantastic.
So that's where they keep the king's skulls and their families down at the bottom. And the one on the left, that's King Ingvar, died in 1934.
All right.
These people, they do the hen hunting, and they're cannibals, they eat people.
The victims of these cannibalistic headhunters are also kept here. Displaying these trophies was an important part of the headhunting cult.
So by eating them as well as keeping their skulls, they would see that as a way of gaining their power.
That's right.
Right.
If they don't do that, the power's going to go to somebody else.
You seem to know a lot about Hingover. What's your relationship with him?
Hingover is my great-great-grandfather.
Right.
I'm so proud to see my great-great-grandfather's skull still remain on this island.
He blows into a conch as waves roll onto the beach.
Before missionaries stopped the practice at the end of the 19th century, headhunters had driven the people of Tetapare from their island. Today, its descendants use this deserted paradise for more peaceful purposes. They turned it into a centre for marine conservation.
What we're about to get into is going to be very exciting. They call it the Turtle Rodeo. Basically, it's conservation, but the Turtle Rodeo sounds a lot more fun. Let's check it out.
The ocean is so rich here. It's home to 5 out of the 7 species of marine turtle. Monitoring and tagging the island's population is an important part of the conservation work here.
So Tony stood at the end of the boat right now, spotting. It's his job to try and identify where the turtles are, and the minute he sees one, he's in.
No, Tony, Nama.
I think we might be on. I think we got something,
Tony leaps in and grabs a turtle.
We've caught ourselves a turtle. Not bad going. And he's a beaut as well. And it turns out that this turtle's actually been tagged already. So in terms of conservation, the work is already done. So the only thing left to do with this bad boy is to let him go.
The turtle swims away.
Then they spot another one. Cue the belly flop.
Wow, look at that. No way.
And this is a huge green turtle.
Whoa, look at the size of it.
And it hasn't been tagged.
Goodness. Tell you what, she's beautiful, but she's an half-reek.
4 of the marine turtle species that live here are endangered, and the green turtle is one of them. The team measure, weigh, and DNA test this female. It helps build a picture of population health and movement throughout the vast South Pacific. And they've asked if I'll tag this wonderful creature.
Okay. Okay, so number is T-00022.
Oh! Then it's time to release her.
She's heavy, isn't she?
Good.
The scientists say she's 20 years old and hasn't even reached sexual maturity yet. With a life expectancy of over 80, she might even outlast me.
It's not every day you do that before lunch. God, what a morning. And there she goes. She's tagged. She's been weighed. DNA's been taken. And apparently it'll be about 2 years before they see her again.
Archive footage.
Even on the most remote of these 1,000 islands, there's still a fascination with the Queen. In both her roles as the head of the Commonwealth and Queen of the Solomons, she's seen as a benign figurehead. In 1982, when the Queen last visited, Mary, a leader of the Tetapare descendants, travelled to the capital to pay homage to her Queen.
As a small girl, I thought of the Queen as somebody really big for my country.
Yeah.
So I was very excited with the other students to meet the Queen. And when she came, we were very happy. We sing her songs. We saw her for the first time. And we thought, this is historical for us.
Do you remember the song that you sang?
Come again and visit us. Come again, our queen. We will all remember you, dear queen. From our heart we say with happy memories of this day, God bless you as you travel on your way.
Zambia on the spinning earth.
On anyone's list of the wonders of the world is Victoria Falls on the border of Zambia and Zimbabwe. It's the greatest waterfall on the planet. Olympic and Commonwealth champion Denise Lewis is about to canoe to the falls.
I've been to lots of Commonwealth countries, but it's almost always been to compete. So you can imagine, I've seen lots of stadiums, I've met a lot of Commonwealth members, but rarely have I had the opportunity to experience anything like this. So it's going to be a real adventure for me. To reach the falls, I have to navigate the Zambezi. And rather worryingly, the river is at its highest and in full flow.
Oh.
Luckily, I'm not going alone.
Dominic.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Denise.
Dominic.
Really nice to meet you.
Pleased to meet you.
I cannot believe how much it's moving. It's so fast.
You have all the time to check for animals. Yeah, so we don't rush, because if we rush, we will miss the exciting things.
So when you say animals?
Yeah.
Crocodiles?
Crocodiles, yeah. Then the other thing is the hippos.
I think you're going to be on your own today, Dominic. No, I'll see you soon.
No, I'm there. I've been on this river for a long time. This is why I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Denise is in the front of the inflatable canoe as Dominic pushes it into the water.
I don't know why I was worried about crocs. I think these rapids might get me first.
Water splashes in, and they're rocked from side to side.
I can't believe I'm doing this!
Denise waves to some children on the riverbank. Now the canoe's in calmer waters.
Keep on checking these areas. The bare ground under the trees.
Yeah.
Okay, that's where this time of the year the crocs could be.
Is that right? Him? That long
that's
thing?
A croc there.
No way. Oh, he's moving. He's moving into the water.
Yeah.
It's coming like this way.
Yeah, it can just surface under our canoe.
You're making fun of me, Dominic. Mm. I don't want to raise alarm, but I thought I saw some nostrils.
That's it.
No, I'm serious. Look. What's that?
That's grass.
Oh.
That's grass.
Phew.
That's a piece of wood rotting. Yeah.
Now I'm paranoid. Now I can see crocs everywhere.
Yes.
They paddle on.
I wasn't very cool about the crocs. I have to try harder with the hippos.
Wow, here's a biggie.
Zambia is home to 40,000 hippos. They may look placid, but they're killers. This is like travelling through an animal minefield.
So how far have I actually paddled today?
Oh, you've paddled for more than 30 kilometres.
It feels like it. I can't begin to tell you how glad I am to see land again.
Oh. They reach the bank.
Oh. Yeah.
Commonwealth champion.
Yeah.
Oh, my arms, my legs.
A hippo's quivering ears above the water.
The river was just the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I still haven't seen the big thing yet. So I've just been totally amazed. But the thing that I'm really dreading tonight is the camping. I don't do camping. I hope nothing creepy comes and drags me out of my tent.
The flickering flames of the campfire, then the sun rising and Denise unzipping her tent.
It's possibly my worst night's sleep ever. Oh, so many hippo noises and creatures and mini beasts.
But Dominic promises it's all going to be worth it. My first sight of the falls, known in the local Tongan language as Mosantunya, the smoke that thunders.
I can see it! I can see just this kaleidoscope of colour just going into the sky. Is that it?
Yes, that's the smoke that thunders.
Wow! Woo! It's incredible. It really is a sight to behold. Just all this smoke just going into the air. Definitely worth all this hard work.
I think I'm a bit scared now.
Just hope I don't go over the edge.
No one is allowed to venture further on the river. It's just too dangerous.
Oh my goodness! I didn't know what I would feel when I got to this point, but it's breathtaking. It's kind of rendered me spellbound. The beautiful rainbow is... It's almost like if you were religious, this would be the gateway to heaven. It's magnificent.
Water in thick plumes of froth tumbling over the edge of a cliff.
This is the largest curtain of falling water in the world. It's over a mile wide, and about 500 million litres of water plummet over the edge every minute. The huge cloud announcing the falls is a spray plume that rises up half a kilometre.
On my travels with Dominic, he said, to truly say I've been to Zambia, I have to get myself immersed in the Mosantunya. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get very wet.
A bridge hanging over the base of the falls.
Oh my goodness! Oh. Woo! I am so ridiculously wet at the moment. I can just about open my eyes. It's the best shower I've had in ages, but it's so exhilarating. Woo!
The torrent of water cascading over the cliff.
The first European to see the falls was the Victorian missionary and explorer David Livingstone.
When Livingstone was here, he said scenes so lovely could only have been gazed upon by angels in their flight. Well, Livingstone couldn't do that, but I'm hoping to get this angel's view.
I've survived the crocs and the hippos, not to mention a night in a tent. I've been soaked by the smoke that thunders. And now I feel like I'm in heaven with the angel's view.
Looking at the falls from her helicopter. Now a bustling street of cycle taxis.
2 billion people, one third of the world's population, live in the Commonwealth. And nowhere on the globe is more packed than the Indian subcontinent. But there's a mysterious natural wonder here that's barely touched by humanity. The Sundarbans Forest straddles the border of Bangladesh and India. It's the largest mangrove swamp on the planet. It's also the realm of 400 Bengal tigers. Ever since the British came here in the 17th century, the man-eating tiger has loomed large in our imaginations. Dan Snow is exploring this dangerous wilderness.
In a boat slicing through the water.
I want to get close to a tiger and find out what it's like for people to live cheek by jowl with this fearsome animal.
In fact, I'm now heading to a place where I'm most likely to come face to face with one.
Kotka is where the swamp meets the Indian Ocean. Mangroves are one of the few trees that can survive in salty tidal waters. It's also home to enough wildlife to to sustain what is perhaps the world's largest tiger population. My guide, Tanjil Rahman, promises I'll get close enough to the beast to justify the armed guards. We're heading into the swamp's dense ferns, the favourite haunt of the tiger, with conservationist Abu Nasser.
So this is where they rest up during the day?
Yeah. There's a two-way. There's one way.
Setting a camera trap is our best chance to see a tiger.
And actually, if you see...
But we may be closer to one right now than we've bargained for.
Be careful, something is moving.
Can everyone make loud noise?
I definitely heard something. These guys are pretty sure we heard what sounded like a pretty heavy beast running through the undergrowth just there. And this is exactly where tigers would be spending the warmest part of the day.
Back on our houseboat, Nasser shows me what a close shave we had.
So this is stuff that you've shot previously?
Yeah, it's a night... It's a night capture.
Is it this place where I was terrified when we heard the feet in the bushes?
Yeah.
Yes.
Very nice. You can see how sleek it is.
Yeah, exactly. You get a sense of its power and its movement there.
And there's it is another place. You can see the deers.
Yes.
You'll see.
Look at that.
Kennels.
What an amazing thing to see it in its natural environment like that. It's like a ghost stalking across the landscape.
Yeah.
And if proof were needed that there are tigers close by, Nasser finds more evidence on the riverbank yards from our houseboat. Fresh tiger footprints.
These are huge pug marks, aren't they?
Yeah, huge. And it seems to be the male tiger.
Look how massive that is. And how old do you think these are? How long ago were these made?
Yeah, it's only... 24 hours.
So within the last 24 hours, a big male tiger has come down here and swum across this little canal.
Do you have any doubts, sir?
Nope.
In the forest, the biggest footprint is from tiger, so you cannot miss it.
So wherever you go in this swamp, you might be just feet away from a tiger. That's food for thought as I begin the next part of my journey. For 2 months each year, local fishermen dare to venture into the heart of this vast, untamed wilderness to harvest wild honey. I'm joining a group on their annual expedition into the mangroves.
Dan is helping to row.
Every year, tigers attack honey hunters, often fatally. The threat is so great, they do everything they can to scare the cats away.
You know, honey collection is the most dangerous job in the world, and that is because of the tiger. And in some bad years, maybe, say, more than 100 honey collectors can be killed by tiger in the forest in 2 months.
Tigers aren't the only problem. The honey the men are after is guarded by some of the largest and most aggressive bees in the world.
Oh, I'm extremely nervous. I don't know what I'm more nervous about, the fact that we're all looking around nervously for tigers, or the fact that we're about to go and disturb a bunch of bees who will be very angry about it, wearing, well, not exactly modern safety kit. Like bank robber, the honey robber. It's a heist, isn't it?
Tying a scarf around his face.
The men smoke the bees from the hive. They believe it mimics a forest fire, forcing the bees to flee.
How about the tigers? Do the tigers, what do they think about the smoke?
When it's really smoky, that is also a dangerous time for tiger attack, because you don't see much around.
Okay, great.
Okay, tell NJ.
They walk through the undergrowth in a cloud of smoke.
See the hive.
This is the time of greatest danger. If the bees flash, the bee equivalent of a Mexican wave, they're about to swarm. Then we need to get out of here fast. The trick is to get the smoke in quickly before the bees become too angry.
As the smoke reaches them, the bees fly off the hive.
You can tell how bees are feeling because there's something about the noise gets a little bit more high-pitched, a little bit more angry. They're definitely beginning to make that noise now.
Cutting open the hive.
Now it's my turn to harvest some. I haven't collected honey since I was a child when I did it with my grandfather. But this is a bit different from the beekeeping he was used to.
So now you go that way.
Oh, wow, look at this honey. It's amazing. That is beautiful.
Honey drips down.
The men don't harvest all the honey. It means the bees can recolonize the hive without having to make another one from scratch. We got away lightly. No bee stings and no sign of a tiger.
Handing Dan some honeycomb.
Feel this bit.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing. Oh, I can see why people risk their lives for this.
Valuable honey and beeswax are their reward. But it isn't just economics that make these men return every year.
Spoke to many honey collectors. They said, when we hear the bees are buzzing, it's in our blood, you know. We can't really resist to go there. So, yeah, despite of all the tiger accident and life, but that's how it is.
Night time.
The closest I came to a big cat was a camera trap. But we heard later that a honey hunter working close to us was killed by a tiger on that very same day.
The low, golden sun reflected on the water.
But the danger the tiger poses has helped preserve this wonder of nature ever since Bangladesh joined the Commonwealth some 40 years ago. Let's hope that in another 40 years, this astonishing landscape and the tiger will still be here.
From the Indian continent to Australia and its surrounding countries.
There are some countries you'd be surprised are part of the Commonwealth family at all. Papua New Guinea, on the edge of the South Pacific, is one of them. The island's isolation and inhospitable terrain mean its interior remains largely untouched, leaving an impressively pristine rainforest. Its people are incredibly diverse. There are up to 7,000 languages in the world, and 832 of them are spoken here. And it shelters at least 39 species of the most exotic and colourful birds, the appropriately named Birds of Paradise. Anita Rani is heading deep into the forest to fulfil a childhood dream.
I finally made it to Papua New Guinea, a country I have always wanted to visit, ever since my wonderful English teacher, the rather aptly named Mrs. Bird, said that she used to live here, and it just seemed like the most faraway, exotic place on Earth. I've come here to try and find something very rare and incredibly beautiful, the Bird of Paradise.
When David Attenborough first came here 60 years ago, it took him 6 weeks to see a bird of paradise. I've only got 3 days to witness its famous courtship display. So, if I'm going to have half a chance, I'll need a local guide to help me.
This is a pair.
Samuel is known as the Birdman of Papua New Guinea. Why are they called the Bird of Paradise?
They thought these birds come down from heaven, fly around, do feeding, and late in the afternoon they fly to heaven or paradise. So that's why they call it Birds of Paradise.
Wow, because they thought they descended from heaven.
Yes.
I've never done any bird watching. What qualities do I need? Because I'll tell you straight off the bat, I am not patient.
The plan is to trek deep into the forest to see the lesser bird of paradise. the male's beautiful courtship display is notoriously difficult to see. So we'll have to be incredibly quiet, which isn't going to be easy for a chatterbox like me.
This is the territory of the lesser bird of paradise. Now, it's not spotted that often, but if it does make an appearance, it should be on that tree there. Hopefully, we'll be lucky.
Anita looks out of the hide through binoculars. The long tail feathers are bright orange with cream tips.
Oh, didn't stick around to display. Oh, but it was so beautiful, it makes me really want to see one displaying now.
The forest canopy.
I might not have seen the birds display their extraordinary plumage yet, but I've heard the people use bird of paradise feathers when they strut their stuff. I've been invited to a traditional ceremony called a Sing Sing with community leader Pim Mamindi. The Sing Sing involves a lot of dressing up. It's clear these people prize bird of paradise feathers extremely highly.
Hello, ladies.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine.
This is looking pretty impressive. Very fancy.
Yeah.
So you'll be attracting the guys?
The guys.
Yeah?
So
me. She's going to attract me.
She's going to attract you. Are you going to attract him? Is he the man for you?
Yes, he is.
You're lucky she said yes. Now we're getting to the heart of it. Basically, this is like a courtship dance. You're trying to attract the opposite sex.
Exactly.
You're telling them you're a somebody.
Yes,
you've got moves.
Adorned with their feathers and paint, the men and women dance. First up are the ladies.
The women have brightly painted faces in blue, red and white.
And then the men join in. They're using the feathers in the same way a bird of paradise would, to attract a partner.
In our society, you can get married to 2 to 3 wives.
Two to three wives?
Yeah, even more. He has to put up a good show so that the ladies will say, oh, this man is dancing nicely and, you know, he's got a good feathers, or maybe you can get another wife.
A man brandishing a spear.
Pim takes me to meet the chief, who has 5 wives.
He said he killed 3 men.
He's killed 3 men?
Yes.
Who are these men?
Ah, his enemies. I don't know.
Who are they?
The chief has a surprising affection for the queen, who, for him, is the chief of all chiefs.
Do you know the queen?
Yes.
He tells me he once tried to see the queen, but made the mistake of travelling to the capital of Papua New Guinea, Port Moresby.
He thought the queen lived in Port Moresby.
Yes, so when he went to Port Moresby, he had a chance to go to Port Moresby, and the queen doesn't live here. The queen lives in England.
What does it mean to Papua New Guinea to be part of the Commonwealth and
okay,
to have this queen?
It is a big community. Commonwealth is a big community. So when we are Papua New Guineans, they feel they're secured, or they feel that there's a network, there's a sort of many countries that are coming together as one under one umbrella because of the queen and the Commonwealth.
The dance continues, then Anita and her guide climb a hillside.
After the people's courtship dance, I'm determined to finally see a bird of paradise display. And I've chosen the most iconic of all, the Rajiana.
I've got direct view to the tree where hopefully the Rajiana bird, the national emblem of Papua New Guinea, will come and show me its display. Now, I've been told that it's on its way because we can hear it in the distance. So it's just a waiting game.
She peers through her binoculars.
D. day 75 and he is still sweating it out looking for the bird of paradise.
The bird ruffles its tail feathers so they fluff up.
Oh, wow.
It dips its head.
Oh, well, I knew it was going to be pretty, but that's just beautiful. Mesmerisingly beautiful.
Its wings are fanned out as it bows.
Well, that is what you call shaking your tail feathers.
There's a noise the Rajiana Bird of Paradise makes that perfectly sums up Papua New Guinea, and that is wow. With its untouched rainforest, its people still living the traditional way of life, and their undying devotion to the Queen. But this is a country that's changing. As it develops, they're naturally going to embrace the modern world. So to have experienced it right now, as it is, has been an absolute privilege.
The bird of paradise has a yellow head and black chin.
We could have chosen 1,000 natural treasures from all around the Commonwealth. But one of my favourites is much closer to home. For our 7th and final wonder, I've come here to Scotland to explore an area of outstanding natural beauty. And it's a place that's inspired writers and artists and musicians for generations. They came to the tiny uninhabited island of Staffa, to Fingal's Cave. The cave gets its name from the legend of an Irish giant, Finn McCool, who built a bridge from Ireland to Scotland. In 1829, this place stirred the 20-year-old composer, Felix Mendelssohn, to write the Hebrides Overture.
A stunning outcrop topped with lush grass. Now a small inn.
On the nearby island of Mull, I'm meeting classical violinist Shona Aitken, who has performed the overture in the cave. I want to learn more about how Mendelssohn was moved by the experience.
He was inspired to write that immediately after seeing the cave. Apparently, he wrote a letter back to his sister with the opening 21 bars of the overture and said, in order to make you realise how extraordinarily the Hebrides have affected me, the following came into my head there.
And what makes it so evocative of the landscape, of the place, of the mood?
Well, I think it's the feeling of the unknown, and Mendelssohn really creates that in his music and depicts the, you know, the ebb and flow of the tide, really, and the crashing of the waves, and it's really quite dramatic. It's like a storm, you know. It's brilliant towards the end. That's my favourite part.
I can't wait to go there. I shall hear your music in my head when I do.
Claire climbs aboard a small schooner.
Mendelssohn made his way to the cave under sail, so I'm doing the same. Local writer Jan Such-Pickard is accompanying me on the voyage.
So, Jan, tell me why it's called Fingal's Cave, and was that always its name?
Actually, that wasn't originally its name. Its original name was An Uair Fhinn, which means the melodious cave, which expressed the wonder of the sound of it.
How is the best way to experience Fingal's Cave?
I think you need to experience it for yourself without a big setup. Queen Victoria went in the royal barge with the standard flying, but I think to simply walk in on your own and let the cave speak to you with its melodious voice.
Just emerging from the mist, you can start to see the black rock of Staffa. Waves are crashing in at the base.
The rocks are like steps.
These rocks were formed some 65 million years ago when an underwater volcano erupted. The water cause the lava to crack and then solidify into these astonishing polygonal shapes. I feel like I'm following in the footsteps of some of the great artists of the 19th century. Writers like Keats and painters like J.M.W. Turner fell in love with this place.
Inside the cave.
I can now see why.
It is like walking into the grandest cathedral you could ever imagine. The scale of it is incredible. You've got the massive pillars like organ pipes. Very, very smooth and cold and dark. And then this roof that looks like it's been sculpted. Man could never have made this, you know, it's just too big, too impressive. And the sound of it as well, so I can hear my voice bouncing back from the wall. You have to be pretty careful clambering over these, but it's worth the effort because the further you get into the cave, the more incredible it seems. And slightly the feeling of terror takes over because these waves are getting stronger and stronger. It's like a natural jacuzzi down here. I just think I'm so tiny against these enormous rocks that are millions of years old. It's incredible, absolutely incredible.
The entrance of the cave viewed from within.
It would have been like this when Mendelssohn came here in the 19th century and the waves creating this foam. The sound when the waves hit the rock and then they come ripping back. It sounds like the timpani in the orchestra. Boom!
Water crashing over the lower rocks.
The explorer Joseph Banks said of the cave, "Compared to this, what are the cathedrals and palaces built by men? Mere models or playthings, imitations, as his works will always be when compared to those of nature."
Fingal's Cave from the schooner.
So from New Zealand to Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands to Bangladesh, Namibia to Zambia, and here in Scotland, you've seen some of the wonders of the Commonwealth. Now it's over to its sporting greats. Let the games begin.
A service of celebration for Commonwealth Day tomorrow afternoon, live from 2:15 on BBC One. On iPlayer, his recent series, Press Red Now for Wilderness, with Simon Reeve from the Congo to the Coral Triangle.